Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with Truth.org, who explains why he believes that President Trump's blatantly racist rhetoric and actions are part of his re-election campaign's electoral strategy. John Garter of the National Parks Conservation Association, who condemns the Trump regime's raid on National Park Service funds to pay for his vanity July 4th military-themed parade. And Scott Edwards of Food and Water Watch, who discusses his group's ongoing campaign to protect U.S. environmental laws from the Trump GOP drive to deregulate virtually all of the nation's polluting industries. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Growing factionalism is consuming Germany's far-right populist party, Alternative for Germany, or AfD, only months before pivotal state elections. In the western state of North Rhine-Westphalia, local AfD leaders resigned over the growing influence of Björn Höcke, who complained that Berlin's Holocaust Memorial is a monument to shame. Reuters reports the German Domestic Security Service is investigating the activities of far right-wing groups, including those with ties to AfD, now the third largest political party in Germany. The security service targeted the identitarian movement after the murder of a leading Christian Democrat politician, Walter Lübcke, by a neo-Nazi man with a history of violence against immigrants. In 2016, members of the identitarian movement climbed the Brandenburg Gate, hanging a banner decrying the Islamization of Germany. A letter signed against Höcke by AfD activists opposed what they claim is a growing personality cult around Höcke and his political faction known as the Wing, which has a large following in eastern Germany. With the rise of Höcke in the ranks of the party, the far right runs the risk of a full-scale intelligence inquiry for members' participation in, quote, extremist non-constitutional activity. On Amazon's Prime Day, workers for the e-commerce giant in Germany and Minnesota went on strike to protest harsh working conditions. The unionized workers in Germany are demanding that Amazon join a collective bargaining agreement, but Amazon has refused. Protests against Amazon were also organized in both Britain and Spain. The first one-day strike against Amazon in the U.S. took place at a giant fulfillment center in Shakopee, Minnesota. Somali workers in the factory successfully pressured Amazon to come to the bargaining table over the issue of Muslim workers getting breaks for prayer during the holy month of Ramadan. 100 workers went out on strike with support from the Awood Center, an advocacy group working on behalf of the East African community. Immigrants' rights activists in New York City delivered 275,000 petition signatures calling on Amazon's web service to cancel contracts with U.S. immigration agencies. Workers at the Minnesota warehouse complain of low wages and the grueling pace of work to fulfill orders, especially for Amazon Prime customers. Workers at Whole Foods, which Amazon took over in 2017, complained of deteriorating working conditions and increased pressure to sell Prime memberships. In response to the strike, Amazon boasted it had recently increased wages to $15 an hour, but critics note that the company cut back weekly hours as wages rose. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, who also owns The Washington Post, is the world's wealthiest person, worth $110 billion. As massive protests in Puerto Rico demand that Governor Ricardo Rosselló resign, the Commonwealth's ongoing debt crisis may be headed toward a resolution involving $124 billion in debt. The bankruptcy law established by Congress in 2016, known as PROMESA, is now being used to restructure Puerto Rico's debt. A federal oversight board is now proposing to reduce the amount paid to some of those who hold the territory's debt, while giving a good deal to more than 300,000 of the island's workers and retirees, some of whom do not even have Social Security. Under the plan, 61% of retirees would keep full pension benefits, while current workers would be shifted to individual retirement accounts. In May, the island's oversight board sued banks and bondholders to get back $1 billion in fees and interest payments. But leading bondholders, including hedge fund Aurelius Capital Management, are threatening to go to court to overturn the Puerto Rican debt settlement. Aurelius delayed a settlement of the Argentina debt crisis for years by insisting on full payment for the debt it held. As debt talks drag on, protesters filled the streets of San Juan, reacting to an expanding corruption investigation of Governor Rosselló's administration. Anger spilled over after 900 pages of chat messages between the governor and his top aides were published by Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism. The posts were filled with profanity-laced, homophobic, and misogynistic messages about fellow politicians and others in a scandal many are now calling WikiLeaks. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Donald Trump's crisis-riven presidency may have entered a new phase last week when he launched a blatantly racist Twitter attack on four progressive congresswomen of color, telling them that they should go back to the countries they came from. The targets of the verbal assault were Representatives Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. This despite the fact that three of the four legislators were born in the U.S., and the fourth, Omar, is a U.S. citizen who came to America as a child refugee from Somalia. The original attack by Trump was compounded when at a campaign rally in Greenville, North Carolina on July 17th, the president's supporters lustily chanted, "Send her back," in an echo of an earlier Trump rally chant, "Lock her up," directed at Hillary Clinton. After widespread condemnation of the remarks and the chant in the media, and by Democrats and a very few Republicans, Mr. Trump falsely claimed he had tried to halt the chants, but later stood behind his initial attack, charging that the congresswomen were not capable of loving our country. The democratically controlled House of Representatives voted 240-187 on July 16th to condemn the president's attack on the four congresswomen as racist. Only four Republicans supported the measure in the first House rebuke of a president in more than 100 years. Your reporter spoke with William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with Truthout.org, who explains why he believes that Mr. Trump's blatantly racist rhetoric and actions are part of his re-election campaign's electoral strategy.
Long and short of it is that this is a campaign tactic. He won in 2016 while losing the popular vote because he won the white vote by more than 20%, which is not unheard of. The Republicans always win the white vote by enormous margins. The reason why candidates like Bill Clinton and then Barack Obama were able to win is because all the other voters, of which there are many millions, came out. Trump managed to arrive in a perfect storm where a great many of those other voters, 49% of them, chose to stay home on Election Day and allowed him the margin to exploit. He has a very narrow course to re-election in 2020, and before he needs anybody else, he needs those white voters to come out for him in droves. It's been a safe bet in the United States to gamble on white grievance in politics for as long as there have been politics in this country. So what he's trying to do is pull back the group that got him elected in the first place. And he's really, I believe, leaning on immigration and all of the racial issues surrounding that because of the significant portion of his voter base, at least, you know, a fair portion of them anyway, over the course of the last 2 years, come to realize that economically speaking, this guy hasn't kept a great many of his promises. The farmers in particular out in the Midwest and out West are getting clobbered by his tariffs, which are going on and on, and the tariffs have begun to expand into the larger business community, some of which supported him for the idea of the tax cuts, which they wound up not really getting. And now these tariffs are cutting into Chinese investment into American companies, which was in the hundreds of millions of dollars and is now all but dried up. So barring any slate of actual policy achievements that he's managed to accomplish, aside from a $1 trillion tax cut for a small group of people you and I will never meet, this sort of tactic is one of the only clubs he has in his bag, and he's exactly shameless enough to use it as brazenly as he has.
William, I did want to ask you about the Democratic Party here. What did you make of the Democratic Party's response in the House of Representatives with a condemnation of Trump's words, but not Trump himself? Many people were very upset that there wasn't a real more upfront and direct condemnation of Donald Trump for what he stands for.
There's been a white thumb on the scale in this country since the first European boot hit the dirt. And the rules of the House were written by a slave owner. One of the rules of the House is that you can't disparage the President of the United States directly. Nancy Pelosi was trying to thread that needle by calling his words racist and not him racist. It's okay if you're a Republican. Joe Walsh yelling, "You lie," at Barack Obama during his first State of the Union address. I've said for an incredibly long time that one of the single greatest strengths that the Republican Party enjoys, modern Republican Party enjoys in this country, is their utter and complete lack of shame. Anything and everything is on the table for use against the opposition if it gets them 5 yards down the field, and because it's about winning, it's not about being right, and it's about protecting the interests that they are there to protect. A lot of the Democrats are still playing by these Marquis of Queensbury rules, and they get run off the road every single time. The censure vote, the condemnation vote that happened, it was like so much else, it was theater. It didn't have any teeth. They had to say something. It would have been better if they had been more aggressive with it. But had they gone and called the President of the United States a racist on the floor of the House of Representatives, they would have given the Republicans the opportunity to have the parliamentarian come down on them and give them all the rest of the day off, and they would have been within the rules to do so. I'm not standing in front of Nancy Pelosi. I think that I love the clapping at the State of the Union, and of course, I love facing him down over the government shutdown. But I think that Nancy Pelosi has served this country very poorly in the intervening months, particularly on the matter of impeachment and on slapping down her own members of her own caucus for the beating heart of the Democratic majority in the House, and especially in the energized base out there. If you want to lose this election in 2020, keep on doing stuff like that. The establishment will always protect itself first, and that is what she has been about.
That was William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with truthout.org. Find a link to his recent commentaries on Trump's racism and additional articles on the topic by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent years, Congress has appropriated $2 million for the annual Independence Day celebration in Washington, D.C. This year, while that event occurred as scheduled, at the other end of the National Mall, President Donald Trump spent millions of additional dollars on his own military-themed Salute to America Independence Day celebration. The cost of Trump's event, $2.5 million, was diverted from the National Park Service, specifically from a $300 million account generated by visitor fees and a special fund to honor the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016. The taxpayer-funded budget of the Park Service is $3.2 billion, and while visits to national parks have increased 14% since 2011 to 300 million annually, staffing over that period has decreased by that same amount, 14%, leading to a serious deferred maintenance problem at parks across the nation. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with John Garter, Senior Director of Budget and Appropriations with the National Parks Conservation Association, a nonprofit that works to strengthen, protect, and promote U.S. national parks. Here he discusses the funding diverted from the National Park Service for Trump's military celebration, the dire needs of U.S. parks, and why Congress should fill the budget gap.
It was vastly inappropriate for a number of reasons. Robbing those visitor fees, as well as fees from a matching grants program, undermined maintenance projects that are overdue, as well as other programs and projects that are important to the visiting experience. Congress was very specific in passing fee legislation, as well as creating the Centennial Challenge Program, which is that matching grants program, that these were things that were intended to enhance the visiting experience and supplement appropriations dollars. One of the things that was so offensive about it was it also went around Congress. There was no effort to check in with appropriators and say, this is the money we're going to use from these accounts, and here's why we think it's important to visitors. They really just said they were going to do it and went ahead and did it without any consultation. It's unfortunate that these needed fee dollars were robbed for the 4th of July event that was unnecessary, because most of those fee dollars go towards deferred maintenance projects. That is the backlog of overdue repairs that is really challenging the Park Service and of deep concern to the many communities that surround national parks, to businesses, local economies, and elected officials, as well as groups that support the parks.
I know there's a huge dollar amount for deferred maintenance that's not in the National Park Service budget. Can you talk about that?
The Park Service deferred maintenance backlog has been growing over the years because current funding sources have been insufficient. So now the problem has grown to $12 billion of decaying trails, visitor centers that have old wiring and plumbing that needs to be replaced, leaking roofs, roads that are degrading, water systems that need to be upgraded or replaced, many things that visitors don't see, some that visitors do. The list goes on and on. Importantly, this is not a problem that can be indefinitely deferred. The longer Congress waits to address this problem, the worse these facilities will become, the more it will cost to address the problem, and the more it will start threatening the visiting experience, because if things aren't repaired, they have to be closed down, and that becomes even much more of a problem.
And John Garter, I just want to be clear. You said $12 billion, right? Not $12
million. Yeah, that's right. Which, if you do the math, is, you know, four times the annual budget for the National Park Service.
What, if anything, is Congress doing about this huge budget shortfall?
So Congress has made efforts with current funding sources to increase support to address the deferred maintenance backlog through the highway bill that is passed every few years, which addresses the transportation half of the deferred maintenance backlog, roads, bridges, tunnels, and so forth. And they have been gradually increasing those funds, which is very important. However, that's insufficient. For example, they're getting somewhere on the order of $300 million annually now, but some of these projects are huge, like the Arlington Memorial Bridge, which alone is $250 million. So those increases are helpful. Congress should continue with that trend, but it's insufficient to address that transportation half of the deferred maintenance backlog. The non-transportation side of the deferred maintenance backlog, visitor centers, water systems, and so forth, are funded through annual spending bills. Congress should be commended for increasing those funds the last five fiscal years, but those are also insufficient, and given current funding constraints in Congress, those current funding sources will be insufficient to address this problem. So something bigger is needed, which is why bipartisan members of Congress have introduced legislation that has huge support, more than half of the House of Representatives, almost half of the Senate, that would dedicate $6.5 billion towards this problem over 5 years. The funding comes from a portion of receipts that come in from energy revenue, offshore and onshore drilling, and renewable energy. In the Senate, it's S-500, the Restore Our Parks Act. In the House, H.R. 1225, it's the Restore Our Parks and Public Lands Act, which addresses deferred maintenance at parks, but also other federal public lands like national wildlife refuges.
How does the future of funding look under the current administration?
This isn't the first time that the administration has robbed fees for other purposes. And we and members of Congress are deeply concerned that they are essentially turning this into their slush fund for whatever it is they want to spend these dollars on.
That was John Garter, Senior Director of Budget and Appropriations with the National Parks Conservation Association. For more information about funding issues related to the Trump administration and the National Park Service, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a twisted July 8th speech, dedicated to the environment in the White House East Room, President Trump made a series of misleading or false statements as he celebrated his administration's environmental achievements. In his speech, the president said, quote, "We want the cleanest air, we want crystal clean water," while also condemning the proposed Green New Deal. Mr. Trump appeared completely unaware of the cutting irony of his dishonest claims, as his administration aggressively promoted the kinds of pollution generated by oil drilling, fracked natural gas extraction, coal mining, and wholesale deregulation of toxic pesticides and chemicals. In response to the speech, many of the nation's leading environmental groups issued statements condemning the president's record. Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club, spoke for many when he said, quote, "Donald Trump is resorting to greenhouse gaslighting the public to try and cover up the fact that he's the worst president in history for the environment, climate, and public health." Your reporter spoke with Scott Edwards, director of the Food and Water Watch Justice Program. Here he discusses his group's ongoing campaign to protect U.S. environmental laws from the Trump administration Republican Party drive to deregulate virtually all of the nation's polluting industries.
Tweets and the racism and the Mueller issue, and you know, it's overwhelming. And the amount of press and attention that his outrageous, unacceptable behavior creates allows people like Andrew Wheeler, who's now the administrator of the EPA, to do his dirty work sort of under the radar. And he's having an absolutely devastating impact on the lives and safety of American public. I'm sure you and all your listeners remember Scott Pruitt, who was Wheeler's predecessor, and Pruitt was sort of this bumbling, clownish kind of character, and was always in the press and always getting attention from his used Trump hotel mattresses to using his sirens to go to lunch, and on and on and on. And Wheeler is much worse than Pruitt. He's very unassuming. You don't get the headlines around Wheeler that you did around Pruitt. He does his job quietly, effectively, and he may be one of, and this is saying a lot certainly, one of the most sinister members of the Trump administration. He is orchestrating an agenda at EPA that is literally killing Americans by the thousands. Just to give you one example, and we can certainly talk about lots of other examples, Pruitt began this, of course, by withdrawing as soon as he got into office, because, you know, Trump is driven to undo anything and everything that Obama did, whether it was good or bad or whether he has a view on it or not, but simply because it came out of the Obama administration has to be undone, undoing the Clean Power Plan. And Wheeler has now introduced what they call the Affordable Clean Energy Rule to take the place of the Clean Power Plan. But if you look at that one little shift, withdrawing the Clean Power Plan and implementing the Affordable Clean Energy Plan that Wheeler orchestrated, it will cost the lives of about 5,000 Americans annually. That's more people than were killed in 9/11. And this is on an annual basis that Wheeler's done this act. And you know, there was some press around it, but given all the noise on all the other issues, nobody's really talking about this. I mean, imagine if somebody did something to take the lives of 5,000 Americans a year. It would be unacceptable, and we should be denouncing it. And many of us do denounce what Wheeler is doing, but not enough people are. I mean, it's just simply outrageous what's happening here at EPA. You know, the Trump agenda, promote fossil fuels, and to hell with climate, and to hell with community and public health. this administration kowtowing to the agricultural industry. At the end of the Obama administration, there was a decision to move into banning several pesticides, but I think the most egregious one was chlorpyrifos. And certainly, you know, that's a highly dangerous, toxic pesticide that's been tied to damaging children's brains. I mean, this is you know, absolutely horrendous chemical that we're dumping on our crops. And Wheeler, once again, moved to save the day and actually stayed any action on this pesticide, says that EPA needs to study it further, even though EPA a couple of years ago made the finding that this is tied to injuring development in children. And Andrew Wheeler saying, oh, they want to sort of study it for another 3, 4, 5 years, kick the can down the road, and allow this pesticide to be used on crops. Of course, you know, the people who are getting most exposed to this, right, are farm workers, many of them who are immigrants, and this administration has clearly shown what disregard it has for immigrant populations here and couldn't care less about these folks getting exposed to this kind of toxin.
What has or what should the Democratic House of Representatives be doing to stop, slow down, or initiate investigations about these Trump environmental policies and deregulatory policies and the connecting the dots between the corrupting influence of money coming from big industries to politicians?
There needs to be a lot more oversight by this House. I mean, they can only do so much, right, because the Senate has shown, you know, a Republican-controlled Senate has shown that they will never stand up to Trump, no matter how low he stoops, no matter what he does. But certainly the House needs to hold hearings across the board on the environmental record of Trump and his administration. So there needs to be a lot more oversight from the House on people like Wheeler and other members of this administration who are, again, and I can't emphasize this enough, who are killing Americans on a daily basis, literally killing them.
That was Scott Edwards, director of the Food and Water Watch Justice Program. Learn more about the group's campaign to stop or slow down the Trump regime's effort to eviscerate the nation's environmental regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KGHI in Westport, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.